CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host. My name is Ryan Young, and Equilibrium is an environmental radio show on CKUT 90.3 FM. We got a great show for you today. David Fletcher from the Green Coalition is going to be joining us on the show. And he's a longtime green space activist in the Montreal area. So many of the valuable nature parks on the island of Montreal are protected places because of efforts like those of David Fletcher. And recently, David Fletcher has been in the news a bit because out near the Technopark wetlands, which is in the borough of Saint Laurent, which is a very rich area for biodiversity, even though it's all nestled in amongst an industrial area with industrial buildings. But there's still a significant variety of habitats there, mature forest, wetlands, fields. And recently, a field that was always called the Monarch Fields, or recently called the Monarch Fields because it was full of milkweed and full of monarch butterflies, was cut down. I'm not sure who was responsible, but there's been a lot of outcry about it because it was right in the middle of the season of the monarch butterfly caterpillars. So we're going to talk to David Fletcher about that and about other things. So stay tuned here on Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. It's going to be a good show. We're going to start off the show with some music from Little Village. And Little Village was a group that had a bunch of different members. Some of them, you know, are famous people like Ry Cooder. Who else was in the band? John Hyatt, Jim Keltner on drums, Nick Lowe on bass. So a very cool little band put together really just for a couple albums. They did this funny song called Do You Want My Job? So we're going to play that for you now to start the show. Welcome back to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. And that was Little Village with the tune Do You Want My Job from their self-titled album Little Village. And that came out in 1992. So as I said at the beginning of the show, David Fletcher is our in-studio guest today. David Fletcher is the Vice President of the Green Coalition and a spokesperson for the Green Coalition. The Green Coalition is a grassroots nonprofit group that's been working for years to protect, to lobby government bodies like the City of Montreal or the federal or provincial government to protect green spaces, natural spaces in the Montreal area and the surrounding metropolitan region. And it's nice to have you on the show, David. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you, Ryan. I hope you're doing well, too. And it's a real pleasure to be here. Once again, it's been a little while since I last visited with you.
Yeah, it's probably been about 5 years.
Yeah, I think so. Like something that. In that order.
Yeah. So lately I've seen some newspaper articles and other stories about this whole debacle over the Monarch Fields, where the Technopark wetland area is in the borough of St. Laurent. It's kind of an area that people don't assume is this area rich in biodiversity, but it really is.
Right. Thing I can do to respond to that is, you know, golf courses aren't typically thought of on their greens, at least. You know, there might be some wooded areas or wetlands that attract wildlife, but generally speaking, aren't thought to be attractive to wildlife. But in fact, once they're given a chance to recover, and this has been 10 years with the Monarch Fields, which is just east of the, just west, of the Technopark, it's had a chance to undergo some recovery, and it's full of vegetation now, full of insects, full of meadow voles, which are a favorite of mine because I know they're at the bottom of the food chain and they just feed everything all the way up to the top. And they're a magnet for mammal predators and for avian predators. So, you know, we've got something growing really well here. It's really recovering over the last decade stupendously. And, you know, there's a deficit of understanding at the ADM as to just what the ecological value of this place is. And to be quite honest with you, it seems to me, you know, having looked at their board, looking at the officers that are in charge of ADM's operations, that there's nobody particularly well equipped on their own initiative to evaluate what the value of that site is. So, we've got the blind essentially leading the blind. And the federal government is really not doing its part, hasn't been doing its part, to hold the ADM to account. The thing about the ADM, you know, is that it's a corporation with a mandate, and of course a leaseholding on those federal lands that have been set aside around the airport. It has a mandate to run an airport. And, you know, it seems to me that they're probably on such a thin margin right now with their operations that they think they can behave as a corporate landlord, which is not part of their mandate. And so, you know, a lot of the projects that they envisage for the Gulf Dorval site have nothing to do with airport operations. Last year we had a project that we had to fight against. Technopark Oiseau played an exceptional role and a leadership role in that. And the Green Coalition, of course, has been on site for decades, you know, understanding the value of the lands, both in Saint-Laurent, in the Technopark area, and in the airport area. So there was, we were able to raise quite a stir about the plans for this mask material making plant. Of course, that's got nothing to do with airport operations unless they're going to use it, as airfoils, you know, make wings out of mask material. I don't know if that's their initiative is. But seriously, the lands around the airport, undeveloped, offer a buffer for airport operations, which is very important. But we think they have to remain undeveloped. And we think the federal government is the proxy owner. We are the public, are the real owners. And we think they, the federal government has to speak on behalf of us, the real owners, to put the ADM in its proper place.
For sure. So all of a sudden, this beautiful meadow with lots of milkweed and butterflies and so on was raised to the ground.
Oh, it was severe. There was nothing, virtually nothing left standing. You know, if anything did survive, it was simply by accident. One or two milkweed plants stood up here and there. But, you know, the ADM responded by saying that it's a waste site, that they had to manage it, that, in fact, there was ragweed throughout. And I've had quite a lot of time out in those fields, and I've rarely seen ragweed, to be honest with you. I've seen things that the uninitiated, the uninformed, would mistake for ragweed, low-lying Queen Anne's lace when it's just coming up from, you know, from the ground, and tansies, which are not uncommon in those fields, have leaves that are reminiscent of ragweed and have an odor, have a fragrance just like they do. So anybody that really wasn't, you know, looking closely at it would assume that there's a problem with ragweed, and there isn't.
And you know, we have this issue in St. Anne de Bellevue, where I'm a city councillor, where we have an area underneath the hydro lines, and we started this practice of not mowing it so that the biodiversity is conserved there. But when we did research, we did find out that it's good to mow it every 2 or 3 years, but you mow it in the fall when all of the wildlife basically is gone.
Yeah.
And the butterflies have already left and so on and so forth. And that as long as you mow it every 2 or 3 years, I think more like every 3 years, you get a reduction of ragweed.
Right.
You know?
Yes.
So, and that if you mow every year, you get more ragweed.
Yeah.
That ragweed comes back faster and is more aggressive when it is being mowed.
Right, yes. And, of course, ragweed, by its nature, ecologically, it's a disturbed ground plant. It prefers the bare ground where it can compete against other things that really can't get a toehold. So when you've got taller plants coming in, it disadvantages ragweed mightily. And, of course, among those are the indigenous goldenrod. Goldenrod gets up to 2 meters, perhaps, maybe even more. And, you know, there's a misconception among the public that goldenrod causes allergies. And, of course, the culprit really is the ragweed that the goldenrod serves to control. So, you know, and the idea is, of course, that ragweed is not a flowering plant in the normal sense that we think of a flowering plant. It's not attracting pollinators in order to distribute its pollen. It uses the wind for that purpose. And, of course, a plant like goldenrod or any of the other flowering plants are not likely, even if they are allergenic, to be able to spread the allergens because they're using pollinators to do the transfer. So I think, you know, if you allow things to recover, that in itself is a control for those allergenic plants that would cause problems for the public. I think, you know, nature is very wise in its own sense. You know, it has all of the mechanisms that it needs to keep things from proliferating. But for the most part, there are some invasives, of course, that have come from Europe that don't have any vectors that limit their expansion. But ragweed's a native plant, and, you know, it responds ecologically when it has to compete with other plants by reducing its numbers.
And so many of the plants in our meadows are not even indigenous, right?
No,
not
well,
even native.
Exactly. Yeah. In fact, there's a very interesting book in French by Mr. Roger Latour, and it's a guide to the native, the urban plants. And when you look through, when you thumb through, you see, of course, that the major part of the flora that we commonly see in the city is not indigenous. It's from Europe or Asia or South America. And that's something that we can work on. Do you know, the public can work on that. And corporations like the ADM, if they have a site that they're supposed to be managing, you know, the things that they could do to help native species get a stronger foothold.
And the monarch butterfly is covered by a certain level of endangered species legislation.
Well, there is. You know what there is? Some years back, I'm not sure, I can't pull up the exact date. The COSUIC, which is that organization, that is quasi-independent, designated it as an endangered species. But SARA, which is the Species at Risk Act, hasn't updated its profile on the monarch to the equivalent status. And so it's only considered to be, according to the law, of special concern. And, minister responsible for that has, of course, been dragging his heels because he knows that Canada and Mexico and the United States, as a tripartite authority, recognize that species needs every measure possible to protect it. So, there's this disconnect. There's this, as I said, dragging heels on the part of the federal government to really accord this species the protection it needs.
So if you could put in perspective for us in general, what has happened in that area, because there's several habitats there and some of them are protected and some are not.
Yes. Well, of course there was, I think it was it 20 hectares, I think, in Céloron. The most of the Gulf Dorval is, of course, within the boundaries of the municipality of Dorval. But there is a part that was used as we called it the Navcan land, because that's where the great globe, the tower, the radar tower for the airport is located. And there were some forest areas that were pretty much undisturbed, with all of the iconic understory plants and small animals, the salamanders and snakes and whatever are there. And then, of course, there was, due to some work in there, development work in there, there was an excavation of a hole that became filled in with water. It was regenerated in largely Phragmites, which is another invasive species, but it's become a marshland that shelters a bird at risk, which is the least bittern. It's at risk in Canada particularly, although it's pretty stable, as I understand, further south in the United States. So yes, to the ADM's credit, it did set aside that land as what is now known as the Parc Nature des Sources. That was a project that the borough of Saint-Laurent was advancing for years, even at the time when it was a municipality. So, that's to the ADM's credit. But it's more than compensated for to the ADM's discredit by what it has planned for these 155 hectares now mostly used by Gulf Dorval for its operations, but with that piece set aside in the north against Aviation Road that the ADM plans immediately and imminently to develop to get the revenues. So we think, this is perverse. It's what in the United Kingdom's Treasury report released at the end of 2020, which everybody should read, by the way. It's by it was led by an economist, Professor Emeritus of Cambridge University, who was given a mandate by the Treasury Department of the United Kingdom to write up a report on the global situation, in fact, not just the situation in the United Kingdom, but the global situation, which would give a backdrop for actions that the United Kingdom would have to take in order to keep up its end of environmental protection. And it's quite clearly, to me, it was a revolutionary document, because I've never seen anything quite like this come out of a Treasury Department's, mandate before. So I think everybody should take a good look at that. And, of course, it places a very strong onus on all of us, corporations, citizens, and all of our levels of government to do what it can to protect biodiversity. I think most people don't realize, you know, our attention becomes locked up in climate change. And of course, that is very serious. We're feeling the effects of it. We're seeing it in Europe currently with the heat wave. We're seeing the effects out in the West with Littleton again under this fire watch. And with all the floods and hurricanes and tornadoes that we're seeing worldwide. Yes, it is a very serious thing. But to me, from my perspective, having tried to look at the whole field of environmental issues, climate change is the fever. The disease is, of course, biodiversity loss. It's the pathogen, of course, is us. And so we have to recognize the pathogenic role we play in protecting, healing, and bringing back to its full the very thing that, in fact, creates the atmosphere. You know, it's the forests of the world and the all of the planktonic species in the oceans and our freshwater bodies that provide the oxygen and pull down the carbon and sequester the carbon that gives us an equilibrium climatologically. And I think, you know, that's something everybody has to be paying attention to. Yes, do look at climate change, but look at the drivers. It's an astonishing thing. In 2018, the proceedings of the National Academy of Science of the United States, PENAS, published a report that indicates that we've lost 50% of the biomass in the planet during the historic period. That's since the beginning of civilization. Our forest biomass, as an example, or plant biomass, as an example, is exactly at that 50% mark. And it acts as a proxy for, of course, all the other things, because everything else derives the benefits and derives its energy secondarily out of plant growth and out of photosynthesis. So, you know, we really have to take that to heart. And we'll have to do a lot more than just stop driving gas guzzlers and replace them with EVs. We do have to do the replanting. But to be quite honest with you, you know, it's not enough to look from a satellite and see forests down below. There's the question of the density of the matter in those forests. They have a certain height, and the trunks, of course, have a certain girth, and all of the understory underneath, and the roots in the soil, and all of the organisms within the soil that depend on the forest being present, account for the carbon that's now the deficit, right, in those places. So we have to, of course, do the replanting, but we're going to have to wait for maybe 200 years before we've recovered to the state where we were at before. And so, you know, we've got to get busy now. And it's going to take resources. You know, the one thing that Partha Dasgupta in that UK Treasury report talks about are perverse subsidies. That corporations, the kind of natural capital that we all depend on, is accessed without us paying rent. And those are exactly his words. We don't pay rent for what we derive out of the natural environment. And so, of course, the natural environment itself has to try to compensate for our, number one, our lassitude, and number two, our profligacy. So I think, you know, we really are at this point, you know, at this point in time, where we have to look at what corporate players on in urban areas are undertaking, as well as out in the hinterland, with respect to doing their part to helping this recovery get underway.
Absolutely. And I'm just amazed at the biodiversity at the Technopark wetland area. And, you know, Joël Coutu,
yes,
bird watcher, birder that's been birding that area for a long time, you know, he demonstrates time and time again that when they do like a spring migration monitoring, they just have the most species of any site on the whole Montreal Island.
Yes, yes, absolutely, yes. Mm. And that's both a wonder, it's wonderful, but it's also a cautionary tale. Because over the last 50 years, and I've been a witness to this, you know, as a school teacher, I used to get out with my children into the natural environment on every possible occasion. And, you know, I and those young people now, some of them at retirement age, are witness to what's happened in Montreal. And so, you know, all of the habitat that used to be there for the birds that now congregate in the Technopark area and in the ADM's lands had more of a place to distribute themselves. So now this is a last refugium. And, you know, the options for the birds that congregate there aren't very many. So, you know, that's another thing that we have to take into account because, you know, that falls on us. The onus falls on us to rectify that and to do what we can wherever we can to make sure that these places that accommodate wildlife are brought back into being and restored. Yeah. Restoration, by the way, just use that word restoration. That's a major plank now, you know, that is being worked on in the United Nations process, the Conference of the Parties process that followed on the Convention on Biodiversity. And they're calling for restoration. The last time round got very little play on the part of our politicians, you know, either federally or provincially or locally, nor in fact very much play on the part of our own environmental groups. They stopped at target 11, which said we needed 17% protected, but they didn't go on three or four more targets up to target 15 to see that restoration of 15% was also mandated. And there's been very little done on that front by the Canadian government or the Quebec government or indeed in southern Quebec by our municipalities. So, you know, we've been given an onus and we have to bear that onus and bear it responsibly. And so, I think, you know, we have to take seriously the whole of what is given us by way of objectives.
And is it true what you say that the wetland there was made by mistake?
Yeah, in fact, yes. You'll see that, and that's not a particular problem for me because, of course, golf lands everywhere are modified. You know, they create hills, they create gullies, they create wetlands. And that in itself can perhaps be a useful modification and something that we can work with. So, yes, you know, there are these obvious things. When we do restoration, it's not going to be to the state they were in before. It's going to be taking advantage of what is already there. If we can get rid of contaminants and get rid of anything that is potentially dangerous, you know, we can make of it something useful.
Hmm. And so the Valerie Plante administration, they've made indications that they know about the Technopark wetlands. It's on their radar. What have they done concretely?
Yes. Well, that's another issue, by the way. Do you know? Of course, the City of Montreal has passed a resolution to protect all golf lands. It's unclear that applies in the case of Golf Dorval, but they have expressed their wish that the Golf Dorval lands remain undeveloped and that they be given a chance to recover naturally. And so that's to the city's credit. When we step across the border into Saint-Laurent, into the Technopark area, including into that area adjoining the Parc Nature des Sources, we again have some modified habitat, but it has in its own way recovered, and there are a number of marsh areas that have attracted all sorts of waterfowl and other fowl, that birds that take advantage of insects arising out of those wetlands. You know, there's all kinds of aquatic insects that in the springtime emerge, so it will attract things like warblers and other birds that need to feed up just exactly that time. You know, there's a certain phenological connection, that is that insects generally emerge at the time when the birds arrive to take advantage of their numbers. And so that's there, and the birds will obviously, all of the birds, 200 species plus, will take advantage of what's coming out of those wetlands. And the wetlands are rich, they're very rich, in plankton and in insect larvae that feed on the plankton. And of course, that's one of the places where I most spent my time with my children, so I'm pretty well acquainted with those kinds of habitat, particularly the vernal pool areas that aren't connected into streams and where fish don't get to circulate in. And so, yes, I think, you know, the technopark area has a lot of value. But so far, the city's been reluctant to go for the full 60 hectares that's available in that technopark area, including areas that are renaturalizing, just like in the fields at the airport land. And, you know, given some proper attention, you know, we can bring that to fullness rather than do the quite the opposite, which is to, as the French say, and I love the word, to mineralize it. You know, there's nothing there. There's Heat Island. There's, you know, attraction for traffic. And so I think, you know, the city really needs, there's an area that belongs to one corporation that I'll allow to remain unmentioned. But it's a significant area next to a marsh area that was at the head of the Bertrand Creek. And that's the IPEX marsh. It's just at the back of this corporation called IPEX, and it fills up in the springtime, attracts waterfowl. And then just to the west of that, there's quite a significant area where there are vernal pools that are attracting muskrat. They did attract beaver at one point. They're attracting geese. They're attracting ducks, one species or another. I've seen turkeys in there. Of course, turkeys are setting up shop in these lands. And so, do you know, again, we have to look at these two choices. And our city claims to be a sustainable development administration. The borough of Saint-Laurent, particularly Mayor de Souza, claims to be an advocate of sustainable development. And the ADM, of course. And most of our municipalities, you know, look at sustainable development, and they don't realize where the roots of that political direction are. You know, where that political panoply of ideas arises from, and it comes out, of course, the United Nations in 1983, the General Assembly mandating an examination of all the economic and environmental issues at that time, and it was at the height of the ozone crisis and the rising of the ozone hole. And so by 1987, we had a document called Our Common Future, and it was the World Commission on Environment and Economics, right? And of course, one of the things I like to point out to the political class that says, you know, we're going to put in very green infrastructure, is that, you know, we didn't have the United Nations launch this initiative and create this thread of negotiations that's gone on for the last 35 years because we didn't have enough development. The need to do this was because that development was degrading the very basis of life on the planet, including our own. It's an existential threat that was addressed by the United Nations in 1983. And so when it comes to looking at these places and the potential of these places, we don't need the development in infrastructure. We need the development in restoration of the very thing that sustains us all, which is the natural environment. And do you know, Montrealers tell me, you know, well, Montreal is a great city. We're a, you know, a city renowned in the world. We're a city of culture. We're a city of innovation and so on. I like to point out that Montreal, to its discredit, is significantly the worst among all Canadian major metropolitan areas for its conservation of natural areas and biodiversity. And that's by its own admission. That's admitted to in its budget, its 10-year budget that was published in December 2020. And it made a commitment by 2030 to address that, and in fact devoting nearly $300 million in the budget at that time to address the issue of catch-up. We have less than half the median figure of Canadian metropolitan regions for conserved areas of this sort. And we include among our figures, by the way, the Frederick Back Park, which has great social value. But let's admit it, it's
it was 100 feet deep.
It's garbage bags with landfill over the top, and we're collecting methane gas out of it. It's great because we can extract the energy before we send the carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. That's wonderful. But it's not a protection of biodiversity, not in the least. And so I think, you know, we have to make sure that we don't get this playing of the numbers and this greenwashing to try and make the record look better. And I think that should be pulled. You know, myself personally, I won't speak for the Green Coalition on this, but personally, I believe that that is should be a grand park. It should attract people to get out and get recreation and to get exercise in the fresh air. But I don't think that they should be, you know, daring to call that what they now call it. And so
the REM is going through there as well, right?
I don't think the REM goes through the Park Frederick Bach. That is at the north end of Iberville and...
I mean the Technopark.
Oh, the Technopark. The Technopark is again, what you were saying, Ryan?
That the REM goes through the Technopark?
Yes, the REM does go through the Technopark. And in fact, last year we had an issue with them tunneling underneath the Heron Marsh. There.
They were going to actually tunnel underneath the Heron
Marsh. Well, they have tunneled underneath.
Oh, they have.
And, of course, there was a serious loss of water.
Right. It has dropped in level.
Dropped. Yeah. There was an observable opening through which water could drop. You could never tunnel underground, however carefully you did it, without disturbing the sediments underneath to accommodate water that would force its way down through, right? And of course, the answer was that, of course, the marsh at the Technopark is refilled, you know, is replenished through the year through precipitation. And I believe that to be correct. And I believe there's an impermeable layer at the top that's gathered over the years, the fine sediment and organic material that has created a relatively impermeable bed for a marshland through which the Bertrand Creek ran at one point, goes up into the Rivière des Prairies. It collects the water there from the spring runoff from the melt, and it has fish in there. That's one of the major attractors for mud minnows are among the species that are there, and that attracts egrets and herons, the black-crowned night heron, the green heron, and so on. So, yes, you know, that is correct. It's not fed from underneath. It is sitting on top, and the water table does drop below and drops down maybe 5 meters below what would be the normal level of the marsh that's there. That being said, the work there did disturb the bed of that marsh and allowed water to filter down and put the very important area in a compromised state. So we think, you know, the city has to be proactive in the future to make sure that nothing of that sort happens again. And even if we had to replenish the water artificially, as was done by the REM people, last year, at the end of last summer, then that would be quite in order if it contributes to maintaining a food base for these very important birds that now have that very important last refugium on island. Yeah.
So we'll take a little break for some messages, but yeah. Our guest today in the studio is David Fletcher from the Green Coalition. He's the vice president of the Green Coalition and also a spokesperson for the Green Coalition. And we're going to talk to David more, maybe a little bit about the Fairview Forest, which is another big issue. All right, so we're going to take a little break for some ads, and we'll be right back after that.
Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources, go to www.rclalq.qc.ca.
The National Greening Program, run by Tree Canada, is dedicated to planting seedling trees across Canada in BC, the Prairies, Ontario, Quebec, and the Atlantic. They prioritize planting on Indigenous and public lands and planting areas of natural and human-caused disturbance. The trees they plant help filter the air and water and sequester carbon, among other positive impacts. To learn more or get involved, go to treecanada.ca.
Whose data? Our data. When you're not paying for a product, you are the product. Especially in web and email services, where multinationals compete to manage your communication so they can make a profit off of the private communication you are producing. Coombit is a worker cooperative trying to help small organizations or individuals get their email, website creation, and website hosting services off corporate services such as Google. For more information, contact us at coombit.org or email at info@coombit.org. That's K-O-U-M-B-I-T. We are not on Facebook.
And we're back on Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the show. Today, our guest is David Fletcher from the Green Coalition. He's the Vice President of the Green Coalition. And Dave, another issue, of course, on the Montreal Island in terms of protecting green space is the Fairview Forest in Pointe-Claire.
Yes, this is a very important ongoing issue. It's just recently been recognized by the Communauté Métropolitaine de Montréal as a site of interest. It's been a site of interest for me for some years, but it's only quite recently, the last 2 years, that I've devoted time to really get an understanding of what's in that forest. It's quite unique. Most of our region in the southwest of Quebec, the 1% of the province's area around Montreal is on a limestone base. It's Trenton, mostly Trenton limestone. It's about 450 to 470 million years old. And it's a buffering kind of bed, meaning that acid precipitation is neutralized by that stone. that mineral that holds all the mud grains, all the sand grains together. So essentially, most of Montreal Island, when you have a forest, has that as a substrate. And so the vegetation is adapted to that. It doesn't have to, it's the species that are typically there don't have in their own right to counter the impacts of acid precipitation. There are, to the north of us, of course, completely different underlying strata. The Precambrian shield is, of course, composed out of minerals of various sorts, granitic and even basaltic materials that very rapidly, at least, neutralize acid precipitation. That's why, you know, we have such impacts with acid rain in the boreal forest and so on, particularly downwind from, the industrial heartland of the United States and of Canada. So here, we have the situation on Montreal Island, where we have this bedrock close to the surface, on an island in the middle of the St. Lawrence, of course. To the north of us, we have plants that are adapted. And so here in this one location, we should point out, too, that the area around Montreal and extending down into Lake Champlain was once part of a large sea that was trapped behind the retreating glaciers for some time. And in fact, there were whales that are enabled to come up and take advantage. We, on Mount Royal, have the shells of shellfish, clams that were there at the time of that sea. There is this history of glaciation that extended all the way down to Long Island in New York and Cape Cod. Those are moraines at the very end of that glacial sheet. But as it retreated, of course, it left behind all sorts of material. In a lot of places, it would be clay, ground up rock as the glaciers grind downwards and bring material down from further north. But sometimes it deposits sand. And so we see a lot of that in St. Lazare and, you know, the areas off west of the island.
Oka Beach.
Oka Beach, yes, absolutely. But here on Montreal Island, we're still mostly with this Trenton limestone relatively close to the surface, some clay deposits, including in Dorval and what. But in this one location, Fairview Forest, we have this great depth of sand. And in fact, it was exploited at one point for construction work, for creating of concrete and so on.
I didn't know that. There's sand there.
Oh, yes. It's absolutely quite extraordinary. And so when you go there, the typical things you'd find just a few miles away in Baudelaire's Park or in the Woods Number 3 in St. Anne de Bellevue, you don't see there. It's completely different. We see species that of plants that have as their species name, not their genus name, but their species name, Borealis. And so you find things that normally would occur further north of Montreal among the conifers and so on. So I think it's very, very special. We find blue bead lily and Indian cucumber, Pipsissewa, which is one that most people wouldn't know, and things like partridge berry. And
I just was looking at
Pipsissewa.
Pipsissewa at Oka.
It's a mouthful. Yeah. At Oka, yes.
Yeah, and it's in flower everywhere.
Yes,
in Oka.
Yes, yes, yeah. Yes. And I was just watching for it to come into flower here. So this site, you know, is very, very special. It is underlain deep down by what's known as the Myland formation of the Trenton series of limestone underlaying, and covered with this. And so the species in that forest have to be what would be acid tolerant or acidophilic. And so that makes it quite unique from an environmental perspective, from a biodiversity protection perspective. Montreal here has an asset that is quite distinct and deserves consideration more than simply on just the area that it occupies. It is isolated, but that can be rectified. There are ways to corridor to bring things in. And on the corridoring issue anyway, with isolated places, you know, we have intelligent animals on the island that are able to contribute to the corridoring. They're called us. You know, we have the ability, you know, the problem with isolation is, of course, that you create this island effect where the gene pool doesn't have a chance to get new input, and there's no exchange going on. And, of course, being intelligent and having, you know, the academic potential to examine and rectify that, you know, we can be part of what transports and makes that happen, at least in the interim time. So I think, you know, it's very important that we not dismiss pieces of land that have these kind of qualities simply because there's no wooded or natural corridor or a dearth of such to connect it to other pieces, you know.
And Montreal did kind of declare, or the CMM did declare an RCI in all the green places,
yes,
which kind
yes,
of covers
yes.
Fairview Forest?
That's right. Well, actually, the city of Pointe Claire itself declared an RCI for 2 years on a project. The Cadillac Fairview Group, which is, by the way, owned by the Ontario Teachers Pension Fund, which are not composed of teachers. They're composed of people involved in finance and investment and so on, right? You know, it's a different
Mindset,
a different part of the population, and you know, with a specific agenda that doesn't necessarily have to do with teaching the public, as the Ontario Teachers Federation does, right? Have that as their mandate to educate the public as to what the world needs and what we need. So, you know, there's this disconnect, right? There's this what would you call it? There's a name that won't pop up into my head. You know, believing two contradictory things at once.
A paradox.
It's a paradox, yes. Paradoxical, internally paradoxical positions on things. So, you know, I think if the Ontario Teachers Federation itself understood just what is going on with Cadillac Fairview and the people that pay their pensions down the way, then, you know, they might weigh in to say, hey, look, this space needs to be set aside. and we're ready to see, our investment team give back to the community something that is really needed.
Absolutely. And the RCI situation, though, coming from the CMM, is a positive step, obviously.
Oh, absolutely,
right?
It is.
And it sets
yes.
the stage.
Yes, I think it is. And, you know, it's now 9 years after the adoption of the PMAD, which was the document that arose out of a process to determine just how development of a sustainable sort would proceed in the Montreal metropolitan community. And it's taken a long time for it to come to the realization that, there's this dossier that really hasn't been paid much attention to. And so this year, and Mr. Massimo Iazzoni, who's the Director General of the CMM's its mandate on the environment and sustainable development, he quite rightly applied an RCI, and that followed in on the RCI that was put in place by Pointe Claire, and that's fantastic.
And for our listeners, an RCI is basically a freeze.
Yes,
it's a freeze on development.
A regime to control interim mare, or it would be an interim control bylaw would be the translation.
Yeah.
And so that buys time, so that revisions to land planning can take place, and we need that time for reflection, particularly now we're beginning to see the repercussions of past behavior that has been entirely development oriented, and that's the chickens are now coming home to roost on that one.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, we're basically out of time, Dave. Time goes by so fast.
I love to talk with you and your audience, Ryan. It's marvelous because, of course, we don't often have this kind of forum where the public can tune in and get to understand the perspectives of the people that are really, really, really fighting now to protect our natural heritage.
And if anybody's ever interested in finding out more about the Green Coalition, they can go to the Coalition, the Green...
GreenCoalitionVert.ca.
Yeah.
GreenCoalitionVert.ca. Go to our website, and you'll be able to apprise yourself of all of our activities and our history and so on. It's undergoing revision. It's been a bit of a dog's breakfast, we'll have to admit, because all of our energies go into our efforts at getting out to the public and to the political class to get action that's needed. So
that's it. But there's plenty of information.
Oh, there's plenty of information
there.
There's all sorts of stuff that's good if you're willing to dig through.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's it. All right. Well, thanks for joining us today on the show.
Yeah. Oh, that's you're quite welcome, Ryan. And I enjoy my time here. I think it's a wonderful opportunity to speak and to speak from the heart, which is where it all comes for me.
That's nice. So we've been talking to David Fletcher, who is the vice president of the Green Coalition, about green space issues on the Montreal Island, and we're basically out of time. You can always follow us on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/EquilibriumCKUT Montreal. And you can also check out our little website, which is equilibriumradio.weebly.com. And you can always email us for comments or suggestions at equilibrium@CKUT.ca. My name is Ryan Young, and have a great rest of your day out there, and try and stay cool.
I went to residential school. I was just 8 years old.
Gaila Kasla. My name is Gennarji O'Sullivan of the Tlaweet Cease Nation, originally from Turner Island. You're listening to Windle, exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools.
Jason Whitebear is one of our youngest panelists. He is a residential school survivor.
Gaki Waku Maganak, Nadeen, and Wendin Naganag. How Mataki was. I said all my relations in three different languages. Those languages were taken away and given with this one here that I've mastered in residential school. And they told me that once you go there, he says, you're not going to come home with this anymore. You're not going to come home being able to speak Nehewewan. You're not going to be able to speak. But when you do go, what I want you to do is I want you to try and master everything that they give you so that they can never fool us anymore. In my generation, we're at the point now where we understand the nuances between the languages. We can say, bonjour, Anin. I wish I knew a little bit of Arab, but you know, the point being is that we're all sitting around here and we're very learned people. We're very knowledgeable. We know how to say, to say a little bit of each other's language nowadays. And that's just us as this language, as this. And I think that's a direct result of residential school, is because we always ask each other, where are you from? Well, how do you say this? How do you say that? So that when you run into somebody else, you're allowed to respect them and say, Tansi, how? Bonjour, Anin. So regardless of what was taken away from me during my residential school formative years, I haven't lost the ability to see. And so it is with this that I thank each and every one of you. I'd like to say, Ninanaskamun, Gakyogi Gwayotsi Wataaski, and that's Cree for I'm grateful for everything in this land. I had to learn that from a kukum, because I was speaking in front of chiefs one time and I said, I can't speak the language. So she taught me that little bit. Hi. Thank you.
You have just heard At Window exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools. Both my mother and I attended St. Michael's Residential School in Alert Bay, BC. This is a part of a larger project called Resonating Reconciliation that engages community radio as a tool to help define what reconciliation is. Resonating Reconciliation is meant to help reconcile all Canadians to this shared history. This is the work of the National Campus and Community Radio Association, the Red Jam Slam Society, and this station. Resonating Reconciliation is also supported by the Indian Residential School Survivor Society and is funded by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. To hear more, go to www.ncra.ca/resonating.
Going back to school always means new things. A new teacher, new subjects, new friendships, or even new habits like washing your hands after recess, having one dedicated classroom, or wearing a face covering when walking around. This year's back to school is full of new things, and it will be memorable, just like every year. We've put special measures in place so that kids can continue to learn in our schools, and we'll make sure every student is well supported. Visit quebec.ca/back to school for back to school safety. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
This is Revolution Church.